First item is Mr. Embry, and he's here. We'll begin the meeting by, may I have a motion for approval of today's agenda for us? Is there a motion? Moved by Ms. Hines, second. Second, thank you, Mr. Fillion. All those in favor? And those opposed? The motion passes and agenda accepted. First, I'll start with the certification. I move that the Customer Service and Operations Committee certify to the best of each member's knowledge and with no individual member dissenting that at the executive session of Customer Service and Operations Committee on July 9, 2015, only such matters as are authorized for discussion in executive session under Board Bylaws Article 10 and only those matters identified in the notice by which the executive session was convened were heard, discussed, or considered by the committee. Is there a second? Second's high. All those in favor? And opposed. Thank you. Exception. The next is the approval of the minutes. I have a motion. moved by Ms. Hines and second by Ms. Porter. Thank you. All those in favor? And opposed. Today's agenda contains several items. It will be a longer meeting, and we will try and be as timely as possible. I want to first bring you up to date on the last Customer Service Committee item that we had on our agenda for approval, and that was the change of rail service. And briefly, to have the public understand this process, we were to move forward on approval of going out to the public with input. Instead, I think we heard a lot of input from not only our stakeholders but in our board members. And that has been postponed to come back to the board after looking at some optimization of details that might be helpful with more information for the public on the service changes that are needed. So that will be back before the Customer Service Committee in another detail. The first item on the agenda, Mr. Embry will provide the summary of the public hearing to accept the Tacoma Park Langley Transit Center into the Metro adopted regional system, and then the committee will be asked to approve all those actions that will follow to open the new amenity for our bus riders. Next, Ms. Barasox will update us on the progress of Metro's changes that they're making in customer care programs, specifically the actions management has taken in empowering its employees to deliver excellent customer service. Next, following that item, is Ms. Burnside's report on the chief performance indicators for Metro for the second quarter of 2015 and improvements. And the last information item is going to discuss the 2015 budget, and the director of planning, Mr. Sean Khan, will discuss that regarding Metro bus service and proposals that would better align, thank you for the panel, align the portfolio that will make up how we will look regionally at non-regional services. And the last item, and I said it's a long meeting, is Mr. Kent will go through the Metro Access report, and this is coming with the work with Deputy Director George Mason University for the Center on Regional Analysis. This study looking at the long-term sustainability of Metro Access services and the recommendations and policies that come along with that. And with that, I'll start with Mr. Embry, and we have a very long agenda, and we have a brief discussion on where we are with the Tacoma Park Metro Center.
I'll be quick with the presentation. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm very excited to be able to present in this fresh new meeting room, as well as to talk to you about one of the latest great projects that we have been working on to support Metrobus in the Washington suburbs of Maryland. We have four actions that we're bringing to you today for consideration. The first is approval of the public hearing staff report to approve the project as a part of the regional system. Secondly, is to amend the fiscal 16 budget to allow us the operating resources to start up. Third is to make it clearly understood that the project will be a part of the fiscal 17 budget process. And lastly, to authorize the general manager to execute the necessary agreements. The background on the next slide, we were here in May and got authorization to hold a public hearing, which we did in July. It was well attended, and there was a lot of positive feedback. It was there were, I think, 7 of 9 speakers were in Spanish language, and we had real-time translation, and very much appreciate Ms. Porter's participation in that meeting. Received a lot of public positive feedback, a couple of comments about trying to retain existing bus stops. We were able to accommodate one request, but another, because the buses are turning left, has to be moved. And those are summarized in the next slide of concerns, where the public expressed questions about the relocations, but also really wanted to enhance and emphasize the need for safety, security, and cleanliness in the facility, recognizing the thousands of people a day that will be using the facility. Based on this feedback, we retained one bus stop. One bus stop has to be eliminated, as I mentioned, because of the left turn. And the proposed budget includes sufficient resources for staffing and contractors to maintain the facility. We also are utilizing Tiger funds to provide for closed-circuit TV, public address systems, real-time passenger information to respond to some of the comments from the public and to provide a full feature amenities for a transit center. The budget for fiscal 17, $967,000, reflects about 6 months of anticipated operating and 3 months of startup. Fiscal 17, the project elements will be included in each of the department's budgets, ties, bus, transit police, et cetera, and all costs will be covered by a reimbursable project agreement with the state of Maryland. The next steps will be board approval, completion of the negotiation of the agreements. They're in final form, but not everybody has said everything and done the reviews, so we'll execute that. And then the installation of the final equipment and all of the startup-related activities, with an opening of the center projected either at the end of this year or very first of next year. So in conclusion, the recommendation is to go forward with these four actions. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Let me ask if we can put a motion on the table with the four actions that are requested. Ms. Porter?
I'd like to move those four actions.
And is there a second? Second from Ms. Hines. Okay, discussion? Mr. Bolger.
In the audit committee, we heard about how assets get transferred from one entity in the region to us, and they go. And is this the case? And this facility will be transferred over to our books?
Technically, no. Because of the presence of the Tiger funds in actual construction of the facility, the state of Maryland retains the title. We will be leasing this facility and operating it on behalf of MDOT, and that's why we have the unique relationship with the reimbursable project agreement.
Ms. Porter.
I would just like to thank Mr. Hamry and the staff who put on this hearing. This was the first hearing, at least that I have been to, that was conducted simultaneously in English and in Spanish. I thought that went very smoothly. It was very appropriate of the audience that we had at the hearing. A number of people responded and asked questions in Spanish, so the Spanish language translation was clearly a necessary aspect for this particular hearing. It went very smoothly. There was a great deal of interest, as Mr. Henry has noted, and aside from some concerns about individual bus stops or the cleanliness and safety issues, people were very positive about this. And so I very much appreciate the good work that went into making this a very accessible hearing.
Thank you. Any other comment? Hearing none, this is going to be a very exciting addition to the, to actually bus service in that area, and I think we should be excited about it as it moves forward. We spend a lot of time on it. Hearing no other questions, all those in favor? And opposed. Thank you very much, Mr. Amory. The next item is the customer update on the customer care program. Ms. Farrell-South.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an interdepartmental initiative in support of Metro's goal of achieving customer satisfaction at the 84% target. And it began some months ago with a SWOT analysis. For those who were not present, the SWOT analysis was conducted to determine what barriers there might be to achieving the customer satisfaction goals that we were close to but not yet meeting. We learned at that time through the analysis and through focus groups and employee outreach that the model was missing some very basic building blocks. Indeed, all of our job descriptions do not contain customer service accountabilities and duties. We did not have, across 13,000 employees, performance metrics that included delivering customer service either to external customers or to internal customers. We did not have performance evaluations and measures of consistent accountability across 13,000 employees that included customer service standards. We did not have tools for all of our employees that they need to deliver customer service through information and other mechanisms to their riders. We did not have in place consistent training across modes within WMATA that delivered customer service information. And we did not have communications, either digital or paper, for every employee in this organization that stressed customer service. With those pieces in mind, we began a program together with many, many departments in this organization represented on this committee to begin to address these basic needs of the organization so that we could get to a new level of customer service delivery. And this is one of several updates that we are doing quarterly to give you a behind-the-scenes look at where we are in bringing those things to modern standards and to the standards that our customers deserve and that this board expects. We have, first of all, piloted a performance training program now that is geared to teaching managers, frontline managers, how to have conversations with frontline employees about performance. Once you put it in the job description, once you have an evaluation standard, you have to train new managers how to do that. Oftentimes, people are elevated into management positions because they're very good technically at what they do. But teaching somebody to be a manager is a different matter, and teaching them how to have a constructive conversation about performance and customer service delivery has been a new training for us. We also began local committees, similar to safety committees, that would address at the local level customer care issues. Those committees bring bus and rail together for conversations at the division level. It gets frontline supervisors and superintendents together in a unique way. And in the first several that we've done, the issues discussed at those local committees have ranged from employees' need to have intranet access at the kiosks in their divisions so that they can access policy and procedure information that we can keep on the intranet, which they don't otherwise have access to customer service challenges they're experiencing now around new student fare cards, for example. And we discovered that what's important at these local level meetings, and we're bringing that back to our safety partners as well, is that frontline employees need facilitation. They need agenda setting when they come together to have these meetings so that it just doesn't become a sort of what's on everybody's mind conversation, but rather it's directed around customer service and safety needs that the organization has and then is engaging and a two-way dialogue. And then lastly, the other piece that we've been working on is a new tool. We call it the Smart List. This grew out of frustration that our station managers have. They do not currently have access in their kiosks to information about the status of their equipment in the station. So if a fare vendor is out, if a gate is out, if an escalator is out, and the customers are asking them, when is this being repaired, when is this coming back, they have historically not been able to answer those questions and have been frustrated not to be able to provide a level of responsiveness to the riders. So we'll talk a little bit, and I'll demonstrate that tool. We also learned through our employee engagement survey work that employees wanted more recognition and positive feedback as well as getting constructive guidance. And so as part of the training that's being offered by the organization, which all 500 frontline supervisors will have by the year end, we are doing a real focus on customer commendations and recognition of good work. We are also launching a customer service awards program and have already done so this summer, and that will be integrated into the safety recognition awards that we do with people so that when we see the best and the brightest among us and the people who are setting the trend, that they are honored and recognized for the work that they're doing. I'm hopeful that now I can demonstrate for you the new SmartList tool that's in test in 6 of our Largo division stations. So what you see on the screen is what our employees will see, what our station managers will see, that they can bring up on their kiosk screen. It's a system map. They can click on their station. They can pull up, and I'm sorry, I have my glasses on. I still can't see it. Is it Friendship Heights? Thank you, Silver Spring Station. And they can see in that what the status is of a gate that's out of service, for example. So in that instance, there is, in the last field, an estimated time of repair and return to service. That's been the missing piece for them. And so as our work order system, Maximo, is updated, one of the things that's happening now is this information is coming back to station managers. And for the first time ever, they can search by station. So as the pilot proceeds, we'll be adding other assets to this list, and they'll be able to look at escalators and HVAC and things like that where they want to be able to tell their customers, yes, the chillers are being fixed and the air conditioning is coming back or the gate is being repaired or that air vending machine will be back next week. The station manager's reactions to this pilot test have been very, very positive. They see it as a responsive tool to what their needs are, and they are looking forward to its full deployment, which will be over the course of the next year, all station managers and all assets added to the tool. This has been, again, another project that's gone across departmental lines. It's taken IT, it's taken rail, it's taken everybody working together because all of our assets have, of course, come online over time using different systems. And so the interfaces of getting the data from these assets and trying to integrate them into one tool that is easy to use by a station manager has been a challenge. But we're getting close. The communications piece has been interesting. In the last year, we gave every employee here an email account, and we thought that would be a leap ahead in terms of being able to have one-on-one communication with 13,000 employees who are in the field, who are not always together in one place or not reporting to an office every day, so that we could talk to them, and that they would check their email accounts when they got home at night, and that that's how they would get information. Unfortunately, we don't see the level of email utilization that we hoped for. We are seeing it more. People are starting to get familiar and accustomed to what they can do with it, but it's still not a real-time way to get information to our frontline employees. So we went old school, and we created a hot sheet, and it's a one-pager with three items on it, and we put it out on Fridays. And when you're a bus operator and you come in to sign in for your shift or you're a train operator, you get this hot sheet. And lo and behold, when we were out in doing town hall meetings in the divisions, and we were asking people, do you know about this project or do you know about that project, they would say, oh, yeah, I read it in the hot sheet. I'm totally aware. So we started getting this anecdotal feedback that that was working, and it was the simplest thing. And so rail said, well, bus has it. We'd like to try it, too. And now we're doing it on the rail side with rail operators, and we're getting the same positive feedback. So we're going to come at it from every direction until we find the channels that best work for our employees and stick with it. But the hot sheet's been popular. Along the way, we've also identified some other opportunities to better serve our customers while we're getting our basics in order. Our lost and found hours have expanded. They used to be 11 to 5, Tuesday through Friday, just based on staffing. Without adding overtime or staff, we've expanded them 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And we've reduced the wait time for lost and found callers from 11 minutes on average to 24 seconds. So with a little focus, a little concentration, a little management attention, this is something that our customers really rely on. the most commendations that I see are from customers when they lose a laptop or they lose their journal or they have something that's precious to them and we're able to retrieve it for them. That is a huge help to them, and so this is an important aspect of what we do. We've been focused over the last year on quality improvements at our call center, and as many of us have converted to our digital devices, we forget that so many of our customers still call and expect to get a human being on the other end of the phone to give them information, but that's still important, and we have millions of callers a year. So everything we can do there to improve the productivity of that center and the responsiveness of that center is important, particularly to our bus customers who still call us. And so over the last year, the quality goals have been met and exceeded, and in fact, our customer satisfaction at the call center has gone from 77% last August to 84% this August with some focused attention, and we've dropped overtime at the same time. So I'm very proud of that fact, and it says that our employees are really delivering there for our customers. And lastly, before I take your questions, Mr. Bulger, I want you to know that the uniform manufacturer issue has been resolved and that station managers are now receiving their new uniforms, and those are being deployed over the next 2 months. So I expect in our next quarterly update to have employees with me from Rob's group who will be able to demonstrate those uniforms so that everybody knows.
Performance plans as of today?
So HR is undertaking a job description updating program. Tanya can speak to it, but basically they're looking at all of the families of job descriptions and overhauling them. That is part of that function, and so not every job description currently has them. But simultaneously with the performance evaluation process that we have here, customer service has become a mandatory criteria for everybody's performance evaluation, and so while those, it's not cookie cutter, it differs depending on your job, obviously, that is proceeding as of today.
I headed up HR for an agency for 3+ years, and we had efforts like that, rewriting all PDs, and that's an endless effort, and I'm assuming that that's not the case here, of course. Is there a schedule, though, to have that incorporated into performance plans? I think it's really important to have a schedule to get that done.
So I'll ask my colleague, Tanya Manley, who's the head of HR, to respond to that.
Thank you. I have a follow-on, just digging into this a little bit. Getting the station manager's information on repairs, staff repairs, of course, is extremely important. What I don't quite understand, though, is what's the expectation from the standpoint of station manager having that information, but conveying that to hundreds and thousands of people walking through a station? I don't really get how we expect that to work and happen.
So it's not so much a broadcast message. What happens is everyday riders, commuters who are frequently coming through the station, will go to a station manager because it's the front line of Vermont employees.
Right.
It's the ambassador. It's the only person that they interact with in the course of their normal commute and say, you know, that escalator's been out now for a week. When's it coming back? And the station manager reports that they'll get that question 50 times a day and can't answer it. It becomes a real pain point for them that they can't respond to the rider. And so the purpose of the tool is to give them the information. And at the other end of the spectrum, the management of those assets will be able to see on a station-by-station basis how many assets are out of service at any one time, which today they don't have a good snapshot of. So if you know Metro Center has escalators out, gates out, HVAC out, you know that the riders in Metro Center are not having a very good customer experience. And so we also hope, in addition to the information relay, that the management focus on this from a station perspective is closer to the actual customer experience.
Well, one recommendation I have is, as a rider from East Falls Church to Farragut West, East Falls Church has some work going on, and so does Farragut West. More signage, better signage in the station, so I don't have to ask the station manager every day, would be helpful. And I'm not sure that we do a great job of providing that information in the station itself. We have good signage from the standpoint of, hey, we're doing work to improve. But I find that we have very little information about completion dates and expectations, so it might be good to couple that to take the burden off station managers.
Fair point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. You know, I think this is really important work. We've been at this for a while. You're going about it in a fairly systematic way. One of the issues for me in this whole area, the strategic plan goal of investing in our people and investing in our assets and how it intersects with our requirement or our desire to provide a quality experience, is that we don't have a lot of things that that really measure that first element. And so while it's good to hear that we've put it in everybody's job descriptions and that we train on it, the real rubber is where people interact with people. And so I guess the challenge I would put to you in this is I think we need a KPI on this. I think we need to figure out whether for a while our KPI is number of problems, employee problems identified and solved in the customer care, you know, number of places we've improved the system. I like the example of the call center time fell, and we didn't increase overtime, but we expanded hours. I think we need to find a way to, while they don't lend themselves quite so tidily to numbers, they are actually systemic problems that you are solving. And Tony's example of the East Falls Church, you know, one KPI could be, you know, how many systems have more than three, how many stations have more than three systems out, or whatever the number is. I don't know what the number is. But we sure want, as a board, to have fewer and fewer stations where there are multiple impediments to a good customer experience. So figuring out a couple of new things that hold us together and help us track that we're getting good change, I think, is going to be really important moving forward. You know, it is all about changing systems and about giving people tools, both riders and our employees. And so I would really, you know, encourage you guys to think about that and come back to us with something.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Brown.
I have a question. I appreciate very much what you're doing, Lynn, to focus on customer care and making it a more central part of what the employees of WMATA think about and formalizing that. And I think the smart list is a great thing. Am I correct in understanding that it's only an internal list, that it's not available for customers?
At this stage, that's correct.
So, I mean, I think this is maybe something fundamental about our relationship with our customers. I think that, I would say the last 300 followers I have on Twitter are WMATA related. People are desperate for more communication channels with us. And if you want to talk about sensors, you know, that help us understand what is wrong in our system, we have, you know, a million daily riders who are telling us that, and in fact who want to be engaged in making the system a better system. And I don't really feel like we have a channel that engages them. I'll give you an example of something that the District of Columbia does in a lot of other cities. They have a 311 system, you know, where people can let you know when there's any kind of a problem. There's even an app that cities have. There's an app that's used across a lot of different types of systems called See, Click, Fix. So you can take a photo of it. It can be crowdsourced. Because the other thing, I think that's a great point to say, you know, like that purple dot should start to glow red if three or more systems are down, right? That tells you something about how bad the customer experience is. But the customers will actually tell you themselves how bad it is. Let me give you an example. Lack of fans in the DuPont Circle Metro while there's no air conditioning there. It's reaching for the people who use that, the level of extreme pain. And yet they don't really have a way to register how painful that is. And our riders would vote on things that aren't working. If we can't instantly fix everything that's broken, believe me, they would give us the feedback if we just ask for it. And especially if we ask for it saying, we need you, we need this information to set our priorities because we can't do everything all at once, and we want the customer experience to be better. So can we do something like this? I mean, like I said, there's a commercially available app that's free called See, Click, Fix. Is that something that could be adapted for use in our transit system, you know, and let people have that? I mean, otherwise, you know, Malcolm and I and a few others will be sending poor Jennifer, you know, our emails like several times a day reporting on things. I report on when an air conditioner doesn't work, when an escalator is going in the wrong direction. I mean, we could get this feedback all the time, but in a format where we don't have to have a person analyze what everything is and then sort it into a pile. See, Click, Fix already categorizes it. So anyway, something that would be easier. I won't keep going on. But I like the direction we're going in. I just think we're not going fast enough or thinking comprehensively enough about the two-way communications we need with our customers.
Thank you. We'll get back to you.
Mr. Dunn.
Yeah, following up on the two-way communications, assuming the station manager has this smartness, does he or she have a feedback to say you promised it by the 19th of August and it hasn't happened?
Share with me how this program is working at Minnesota Avenue Station and Anacostia and Congress Heights.
In what way specifically?
In terms of customer care. How are we doing in terms of customer care in those three stations?
So the information that I have about the customer's experience in those three stations is that the most pressing issue, apart from service reliability, which is number one for both bus and rail customers in those locations and others, is that at those locations that you mentioned, security is also one of the top concerns for those customers. And I could expand on that just in terms of the chief and the MTPD has a program right now to try to reduce the most frequent conflict between customers and station attendants, station managers, is over fare disputes. And so trying to have police on hand who reduce those conflicts, we've incorporated fare conflict resolution into bus and station manager training to try to reduce that conflict and improve the customer experience in those stations. Those would be the most direct applications of what we're doing at those locations.
Do you have comments in reference to cleanliness and problems with construction programs going on out there that represent the safety risk?
Frankly, we don't.
Yeah.
Those customers are more concerned about personal safety.
I just want to back up Mr. Price's what he was saying, and I'll extend it into Maryland. And I will say that part of the gap I think that you've identified is that there is not a good way for you to hear, like I had to hear in the metro station this morning when there was all those people there waiting, going past Minnesota Avenue, and there being construction materials that I've had to ride by. Narrows, you know, that you're not getting that feedback, and that the customer satisfaction KPI, which only gets 400
or some odd responses, or that's the goal. Simply not giving you actually a good picture of what the concerns of the customers are. And I think that's really, you might have one, your thoughts and where you are, but then there's also what's happening on the ground with the people who are in the system. That's bus and rail. And I think that there does need to be a much broader understanding of what the customers are experiencing. And that has to, that information needs to be percolating to you in various ways.
So I appreciate that. And I invite your recommendations about those channels. I'm very open to them. Obviously, we have customers calling into us, and that's one way we know. We have customers emailing us. That's another way we know. We do actively research, survey our customers to learn. I went out earlier this year, I know Mr. Price did likewise, and stood at Anacostia during the afternoon rush with our station managers to learn what the experience was. And again, whether it was customers I was talking to, the four police officers who were stationed there, or the station managers, fair conflict was the central theme that I've heard from everybody. So in person, again, that's what bubbles up to me. So if there are other concerns, we'd like to capture them, we'd like to address them. I'm interested to know how you're getting that feedback and what you think can be shared or what you think we could do to extract it at a different level.
Well, one of the major concerns I had is I end up hearing from the council members about problems and things of that nature, and I took the liberty of going out to Minnesota Avenue, and they had significant issues out there, and Rob Troop and I paid a visit out there, and I have to say he did correct everything, and I'm very pleased with that. But we have to figure out a way for us to be notified within the company without external sources in terms of our legislators bringing it to our attention. It makes us look ineffective in terms of running the business. So do you have any programs or possibilities of looking at more troubled stations that we have, how we communicate? And communicating with DuPont Circle versus Minnesota Avenue, Anacostia, and Congress Heights is completely different. So we have to find an effective way of communicating with that population as well.
If I could come back to the board with some suggestions, we will look at that a little more deeply. I can think of some things off the top of my head, but I'd really like to talk with folks about what they think would be effective there and that we could sustain on a systemic basis and prioritize the kind of issues that you saw there.
I appreciate that. That's going to be my focus in terms of serving the board from a customer relations point of view, looking at those areas where we have historically overlooked. And I do not want to have a situation a tale of two different cities.
I
feel very strongly about that because I experienced it firsthand here with Minnesota Avenue.
Okay.
Yes, thank you very much. I have two suggestions. We've had very effective and I think meaningful outreach performed over the summer through DDOT. Focused on transportation safety. So we had 10 pop-up events, most of which were at metro stations, actually, around our Vision Zero initiative, which is to drive transportation fatalities and serious injuries to zero by 2024. We had about 300 to 350 contacts for each one of those events, and the events were done over about probably 2.5 to 3 hour duration. So, I do think that there are ways to make kind of deep connections with your customers, and we need to accelerate that. So I would encourage you to talk to the folks at DDOT. Jonathan M. Rogers is the point of contact. I can provide his phone number afterwards. But I do think we need to accelerate and extend our connections with customers. With 13,000 employees and the resources that Metro has, there really is no excuse. If a little agency like DDOT with 900 people and a fraction of your budget can do it and can get out there and and listen and understand the concerns of the customers, there's no reason Metro can't do that. And the feedback isn't, some of it is, is critical, negative, a lot of it, and most of it is, and we've got to get out there. So I think we really need to do a better job on that front. And rather than just, you know, chastising management about what they need to do, my second suggestion would be, and I've talked to many of the board members here already about this, and I'm encouraged that nearly everyone, I guess everyone that I have spoken to is willing to do this. We'd like to get out there and interface with the customers more. So I would ask that management schedule opportunities for all of the board members to do Fairgate greetings and interface with the customers in the mornings and in the evenings, and to schedule some time for us to do some ride-alongs on the bus. And we'll just do this. We'll lead from the front. We'll lead from the front. But you schedule it, and we'll work it out, and we'll sign up, and we'll get out there. And so it won't be as informal as the stuff that we've been doing day in and day out, like my trip this morning on the D6, where it was 15 minutes late, and it was so overcrowded that I decided to walk here, and I let the elderly passengers and the pregnant women that were at my bus stop board the bus, and I walked here. We're going to get out there. We're going to talk to the customers. We're going to lead from the front, and you guys can follow us. But we really have to do a much better job. So we need to modernize our customer interactions, and some of this is, I think, you know, step in the right direction, but it's kind of a baby step as far as I'm concerned.
So thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to have the board members come out with us and do customer-facing events, and we'll certainly schedule that and take advantage of your schedules to do that. I also would appreciate the opportunity to brief you, Mr. Jones-Joel, or send you a memo about our public participation plan, which is a board-approved process for outreach into the communities that we started this year. It has us reaching out electronically, in person, through pop-up events, through community outreach activities. We do meetings with community-based organizations that are religious, traditional, environmental, all kinds of community groups that have us come in and talk about our service plans. It's been a very successful model. It's been one that the FTA has pointed to as a best practice among other transit properties. We're out in the community in a very aggressive way, and so I look forward to the opportunity of sharing that information with you, and hopefully it will address some of the concerns that you expressed.
Mr. Yule and Mr. Bulger, and I think we'll have to move on to the next agenda item. Okay.
Yeah, I'll be very quick. First of all, thank you for the update and the progress that's being made. It's somewhat troubling that for an agency that's almost 40 years old, that we're just getting to the status and the stage in terms of improving and enhancing overall customer service and communication, particularly with the 13,000-plus employees in our workforce. I mean, obviously, technology has changed. We have better tools and resources available to us today that we didn't have even 2 years ago. But this, you know, we certainly should have been far ahead of the curve. And while we've always promoted and advocated for customer safety and service efficiency, I'm saddened that we're just really getting to do a lot of these things, but they're good. It's all good news, and hopefully it will work. My final statement or comments is that I think what really would help, particularly us as board members, is just getting timely responses back to, and we particularly shoot the staff, concerns from our citizens, our clients, and then, you know, we don't get a response back, and then, you know, my staff has to then do a follow-up another second time. That just doesn't happen. I mean, that's not good business. Thank you.
Mr. Bolger.
I wanted to follow up on my colleague's idea that I thought you were going to bring up, Lee, was that we have a picture of the board of directors that are on the trains, not on the buses. We do not have that as a lead from the front example. No, we don't. No, we have our pictures outside here, but our customers don't know who the hell we are. So let's get that done. And anecdotally, Harriet's point about 311 in the district, I don't know if Maryland and Virginia have 311. Okay, so how can we figure out a way to at least ask the question about using 311, which I just used last week because they had a new route for our recycling pickup. Okay, I got an email instantaneously. I got another email saying that it was fixed, that they picked it up, and another email saying, could you give us your feedback? I mean, it was amazing. So I don't know if we can partner with 311 in any way, but let's look into it.
Okay, thank you very much, and the feedback, and I'm glad that it has gotten this much discussion because I think it's a very important point. I think we should all use our tools that we have and actually be those communication pieces because I think you can, just as we're asking and saying that our customers can provide us better information so that we can serve them better, we can do so anyway. You know, give them a car number that doesn't have the air conditioner that you're riding on or the bus that, whatever. It's really important. But I think most importantly, when we come to those station managers, they do need our feedback. They see more than we often see, and without the organization supporting them, it's very hard for them to make do. And I have seen the opportunity where some have gone and been extremely creative, absent the tools that they need, and this is very helpful that we're moving that way. I'm going to move on to the next item, and it is the vital signs reports that Mr. Bernstein is going to give us a report. Thank you. And maybe you can do the highlights, and because we do have the full report.
Yes. Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning to members of the committee and board. I have a very brief presentation on the highlights, as you suggested, of quarter two of calendar year 2015, and that covers the months of April, May, and June. The results reflect how we're performing against the targets that we set for ourselves in this calendar year. But before I move to the specifics, I just wanted to open with some positive news. Our vital signs report last week was selected by the Transportation Research Board Special Task Force of the National Industry Best Practice in Communicating Information to Support Data-Driven Decision-Making. We're going to formally showcase at the TRB meeting later this year in various panels and poster sessions. So that's great news for us. As you know, under federal rulemaking under MAP 21 has really increased emphasis on performance management, and WMATA even 2 years ago was recognized for having many of the elements being put in place for a performance-based organization, and that includes what the board has done by setting the strategic direction for the organization with four goals, which is a starting point, as well as listening to the results, which you're doing today with vital signs. Okay, now let's move to the quarter two results. Starting with the bus KPIs, bus on-time performance continued to experience challenges and for the first time in 4 years hasn't outperformed the prior year. We're 1% lower than last year at this time. Particular area of concern is increase in late arrivals. And some of the attributes we're evaluating include road construction delays and possible unintended consequences of implementing disciplinary and bus fare evasion initiatives. I would also note from a human capital point of view that 40% of our bus operator workforce is now with less than 5 years' experience. So that's been changing over the years, and they have pretty low seniority at this time. Turning to performance of the fleet, manufacturer-related failures continue to challenge bus fleet reliability. And we saw performance decline by 4% or 145 more mechanical failures compared to last year. Among some of the fleet challenges listed in vital signs are new NABI hybrid buses that were already delivered 18 months late due to production and industry restructuring issues have been prone to manufacturer-related problems, and we're continuing to work with the manufacturers to address the failures. And then customer satisfaction, as you know, is measured by irregular surveys of our customers who have ridden Metro in the past 30 days. We had some discussion about that in the prior item. These results are summarized every quarter. We've seen that bus satisfaction has dipped slightly to 75% due to some of the issues I just discussed. Let's move to rail. Rail on-time performance was significantly worse than last year as rail cars stayed in maintenance yards for repairs and maintenance. In inspections in May and June, and we left our customers with less frequent and when it did arrive, more crowded train service. We did approach target earlier in the quarter in April.
when we have fewer cars that depart from end-of-the-line stations, the time between trains increases. That's technically known as headways, and that lowers OTP, on-time performance. Rail fleet reliability, a key driver of on-time performance, was worse than last year, as meeting the Silver Line car requirement of 954 cars continued to be a challenge. I talked about that last quarter. We had some additional difficulties arise with the removal of all the 4,000 series cars for inspections in June, as well as declining parts availability. In April, early in the quarter, we made the 954 car requirement available for service on all but one weekday, but by May and June, we fell below the requirement on most weekdays, so that the tables turned significantly. Problem areas were propulsion and door failures. We did place 16 7,000 series cars into service. It's now up to over 30, but those are only a small percentage of the fleet, so they won't impact the performance for some time. Rail customer satisfaction declined to 73% as customers waited longer for trains that were more crowded. Moving to safety, you recently received the update from the Safety Committee, on the quarterly safety report that covers our indicators for our customer injuries and employee injuries. And those results are included here again. I won't go into detail since we're short on time, but overall customer injuries improved over the quarter but are still slightly worse than target in the prior year, largely driven by bus collisions. Employee injuries are worse than target in last year, with collisions, slips, trips, and falls being the leading cause. Chief Pavlik is going to be back in a couple weeks with the crime report, so I won't go into detail on that at this time. Moving to vertical transportation, and a good news story that reflects the investment in assets and people that we've made over the last couple of years. Through 2020, Metro plans to spend $430 million to rehab 90 elevators, 144 escalators, and replace 114 escalators. On the human capital side, the board has given the budget to add 20 more mechanics to service the units, and the results are showing. Escalator availability reached 93.5% this quarter, better than target and last year. Improvements come from replacing troublesome models, better root cause analysis of the breakdowns, and good maintenance practices. And on the elevator side, we're meeting the target at 96.5%. Despite units being out of service for modernization, that number has doubled since last year. We average about 5 at any given time. At the same time, our repairs times have decreased by 2 hours on average compared to last year due to better management of our human resources and having the units in better condition so that when they do unexpectedly go out of service, we can repair them faster and the repairs are less intensive. In closing, as I started out, I said it's an important role that you play listening to the performance here, whether it's good. We've been able to report in past years year-over-year improvement in many measures. This year has been a particular challenge. 2015 has really gone the other direction. But it's important for you to listen and ask questions about that, so I appreciate that. And I would be happy to answer any questions, as well as we have other subject matter experts here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Bernstein. Are there any questions regarding the report? You have the total report with you. Mr. Bowman.
Thank you. Thank you for your report, Ms. Bernstein. I provided you with just a visual little report and just distributing to my colleagues. I'm going to just focus on the issue of rail reliability because you pointed out in your report that there have been problems in the last quarter there. And I think the visual that I've distributed to my colleagues and yourself and Mr. Troop, which was prepared by the Maryland Department of Transportation, puts that problem in some focus. But anyway, on page 6 of your rail reliability KPI report, you point out that after making 954 rail cars available for service all in the one week, and rail car availability fell below the requirements for most in May and June, and that was related to the unplanned campaign to remove the 4,000 series rail cars for door and some other problems. And you also indicated in one of the bullets that there's some procurement issues there. The visual that I just distributed puts that into focus, and it shows that in the last 3 months, the number of cars out of service was in the range of 200 to 250 per month, which had been the rise from the prior 2 months when the number of cars out of service looks like it's about in the range of 130 or 140. So the question is, I guess the first question is, do these look like, does this chart look like an accurate rendition of the statistics that you've looked at in preparing the vital signs report? I just want to make sure that we're not blindsiding you when you think that this is not a visual portrayal of something that's inaccurate.
I think one thing is we were very intentional, though, in utilizing six-car trains Monday and Friday, so that's going to be reflected in some of our reductions in the car count, so the fact that we're intentional about it is going to be reflected in here as well. It's not just a matter of having cars out of service. However, what I want to be very clear is that we did have a significant amount of cars out because we were awaiting parts. We had almost 54 cars out because we were awaiting journal bearings. One of the issues with the journal bearings was the T's and C's, the terms and conditions on the journal bearings, but we were trying to negotiate that. So we did have a number of cars that were out of service while we were waiting for procurement of parts on those. Again, some of this was intentional because we went to the six car trains on Monday and Friday, but we did have some significant issues holding cars out because we were waiting for parts. A lot of that was negotiating different T's and C's with the different parts manufacturers.
Right. I mean, the point I'm just trying to make with the chart is that even we've solved the 4,000 problem with the doors and everything, and those are now in service. But the number of cars out of service still seems to be at that high level. So the question is that because they required additional maintenance that kept them out of service through most of July and August?
It's a combination. It is not just it was intentional. We intentionally reduced the number of cars that we're putting out on Monday and Friday. But we had a significant number of cars that were out waiting parts. So while, you know, if this chart would be a little bit less, you know, the month of July and August, had we intended to put eight-car trains out on Monday and Fridays, the numbers wouldn't be as bad, but they would not be good because, again, cars were sitting in the yards awaiting parts. So that's
what I'm trying to get to is where are we today in the month of September? Are we back down to where we were in April or May, or even better, where we were in 2013?
Yes, we are catching
what
up.
What can our customers expect for the month of September and October?
See better improvements on this. We successfully negotiated with a number of the parts suppliers on these, on the T&Cs. The journal bearings is one of the ones that was significant. We're catching up on that. So we're starting to catch up on that. I'm doing the analysis now to understand exactly what that'll be based on where we are. We have just closed the procurement out for it was an engineering modification for a propulsion package. So we're doing that analysis now to be able to identify those. I don't have a clear answer because I'm just now getting the parts availability in for those cars.
I'm just trying to get us to be a little more transparent as we're in past discussion with our customers. We need 954 cars.
Correct.
Out there. How many are we running? Where are we now so that people will understand whether they should be anticipating a greater level of six-car trains and therefore crowding than they've anticipated in the past, or whether the experience we've had in July and August is continuing into September and October?
We're like 900, 920. You know, it fluctuates. Again, you know, we're working out of the hole right now on that. The intent is, like I said, I just need to be able to provide that analysis based on, you know, how many cars we had sitting, parts availability, when those parts are going to come in, when those journal bearings are going to come in, when the additional parts for the propulsion package on the EMI. We're in the process of doing that analysis now to figure out where we need to catch up on that.
Is that an analysis you can get to us by close of business tomorrow?
Probably not, no. Give me to next week, if you will.
Sometime next week? Mm-hmm. I think we'll look forward to seeing that.
I was just going to say, in response to some of the specifics that you asked, you showed here on your chart, and we can talk to MDOT about this, that sometimes there were as many as 250 cars not operating. I don't know that that's accurate because I don't think we ever reached that level. But I don't know what this the per month. Okay.
This is
okay, we'll look at it on daily basis.
This is not for that. This is aggregate.
Okay. So that in that case, that probably sounds accurate. On average per day in the month of July, I don't have August stats at the moment. There were 888 cars available on average, and that of course goes up and down by day. But so that's down approximately 80, I think.
Okay. I mean, if there's anything inaccurate to this, could you
certainly
give us a note?
Yep.
Where you think there is an inaccuracy in this?
Yeah, just make sure what the source of their data is and how they're portraying it.
And just for clarity, where, Mr. Troop, are we with the procurement issue? Is it resolved, or is it in progress of being able to get?
Parts of it are resolved.
So we will still have some impact.
There's a potential for impact.
Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, that's a good question, and also probably a new KPI we need to have on our list. You know, just basically giving us the car availability, not only identifying what's available, but not necessarily deployed, but also what's down hard, if I can use the word hard down or not available for service. So it seems to me it's a good KPI to add to our system.
And it's actually something that we get to the FDA.
We're going to keep moving, and maybe go to Augustine.
Okay, so,
Mr. Augustine, I was going to come around.
Thank you. I've got a few questions. One is, on the on-time performance, if you have, how are you measuring that? So, for example, if you've got planned track work, and so then you linked in the times or the headways between it, or you get a late start. Does that hit the on-time performance? I mean, do you set the number based on 6 minutes and doesn't matter, you don't change it, you don't move it based on, some conditions that you may find?
That's correct. We do not change it.
So it does take into consideration, or rather it does not take into consideration planned maintenance.
Or it does not. Or, for example, when we on snow days, if we widen the headways out on snow days, that also impacts our on-time performance.
It will negatively impact the on-time performance.
Okay, so
we're seeing a clear
intentional. So we're seeing this.
So we do get a clear picture based on that of on-time performance based on the schedule that we want to have, basically, right? Okay, so that's good.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to make a note on that is we try to establish our measures so that they are customer-friendly. So, for example, on escalator availability, the customers don't care if the escalators are down on purpose for maintenance work. They just know that it's not working, and we count that against ourselves. Actually, if you look on 57 and 58, the definitions of all the measures are there, and it goes into detail about
how
we calculate them.
On the complaints per million customers, how are you capturing that? And I want to know that. And then I want to understand, based on that being in the green, how you kind of square that with, at least in my experience and the experience of board members, as far as satisfaction of the public. Additional to the other things that are going on, there needs to be an active campaign that is dealing with the customer satisfaction. I would expect to see, I would hope to see some key actions that are going on to try to address that. And that's just a comment.
Okay, Ms. Fragoni.
Thank you. So I want to turn your attention to the summary that's up there where we have on-time performance and rail, fleet reliability, and customer satisfaction. And that I would argue that that you might see a correlation between fleet reliability and customer satisfaction, but we have people are even more unsatisfied to look at that statistic than might be warranted by our lack of on-time performance or fleet reliability, and that's because information is currency, and I would say we're not doing a good enough job giving our customers the information they need to have about performance. And I know, I mean, I get hundreds of metro alerts, but they're just not always accurate. In fact, sometimes I feel like metro overdoes it. It says expect delays here. I go into the station, no delay. It's totally fine. But I'm not unhappy about that. I'm actually more happy. So in some way, it's better to over-prepare people, because people do have choices, and that sometimes being late means missing something critical. The false negative is better than the false positive when it comes to reliability and on time. And so whatever we can do, and I've sent Jennifer some specific examples of this. One of the examples from the last week is the late clearing track work, and I totally understand that when you know, we have a scheduled maintenance, when we get in there, conditions are different, safety is a factor, and so of course we're going to make it safe, but we're, you know, the point I raise is that we're still charging people a rush hour fare when they are not getting rush hour service. They're getting single track, they're getting, you know, they're getting something less, and that you know, we have the ability, don't we, to be more dynamic in even what we charge fares. I mean, is that correct or no? Can we do that electronically and from a single location?
I do not believe. My understanding of the system is we cannot adjust fares proactively, knowing that service, that the peak hour service would not start till 6 a.m. That we're not able to adjust the fare gates to charge an off-peak fare, say from 5 to 6 a.m. in the morning. Everything would have to be retroactive.
But it could be retroactive. So there are two points. One point is just the communication, more false negatives than the current false positives because of the stakes for our customers. Like, we need to be better on the accuracy of the information when we know something unexpected happens. You know, we do a lot in the system to have cars in the ready in case there's a breakdown, but it just doesn't always work. It's one thing to go in expecting an 18-minute headway. It's another thing to get a 40-minute headway, right, without any notice about what's going on. That's really infuriating to our customers. And the other thing is when we are regularly encountering, like we did this week, a lack of rush hour service when people are getting charged for rush hour, we should make an adjustment. Even a nominal adjustment acknowledges the inconvenience that we're causing our customers, even if they would agree for the reasons we're doing it, for safety, right, and the conditions that they found. But again, that could be better communicated to our customers as well. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Okay, so how do we communicate better rail car availability when we're receiving new rail cars? And I want to know how many rail cars we're getting, how's it working, are they on schedule, the 7,000 rail cars? So we can tell our customers that we're getting these new rail cars?
Yeah, we have a number of them in. We have three units that we're using to train our operators on that. The 7K is a little bit slower than we would like. The delivery of the 7Ks is a little bit slower.
How slow?
We're getting about 12 cars a month. We were wanting to get 16. We're getting about 12 cars a month.
Why?
On that. A lot has to do with the software issues that we're encountering. So as they go back and they change the software on the cars to be able to fix the software that's in them.
Kawasaki's changing the software, or the subcontractors changing?
No, Kawasaki's changing.
Okay. Yes. And how's that developing, or how do we communicate that fact? Except little snippets that said software, and we say it's like they're getting a new car, and the first time you bring it to get service, they put a new tweak in. How do we communicate all that?
To our customers?
Yeah, or to the board. I mean, I'd like to know, you know, I didn't know we were getting 12 rail cars versus what you said. First I heard of that. What else on the new rail cars?
Well, that's where we are with the rail cars in that regard. So we're a little bit behind.
We've had a report. We announced the last introduction and what the number was, and it may be good to repeat where we were on the rail car, new 7,000 car. Is that, that's your question?
Yeah,
yes.
I just think we should be
more
open about, hey, we're not getting fewer rail cars than we thought. There's a software glitch that's getting fixed, I hope. Can we say that we'll get back to the estimate of delivery of the rail cars, or are we stuck at 12 a month?
We will get back to the delivery of 16 a month.
Yeah.
We expect to do that probably around the December time frame on that.
Okay. I want to keep moving on this item. Can I have your question, Leif, and then to the next agenda item?
Sure. Yeah, just two lines of inquiry. One has to do with the inventory, so the supply, the spare parts. So presumably you have replenishment levels. Okay. So how many categories of parks are below the replenishment level?
If I have that information.
Okay. Okay. And are they, so do you have, are some of the parts exhausted?
Yes.
Exhausted.
Yes.
So we do not have any spare parts. Okay. That's concerning. Are there examples of parts that WMATA staff will fabricate themselves?
Not on the rail cars. There's on elevators and escalators, we do. The rail cars themselves, we generally don't fabricate those parts ourselves.
So you do not fabricate any parts for rail cars?
I am not aware of any, but we do. I know on the elevators and escalators, I'm not aware of any regular parts that we maintain that we fabricate ourselves. I will certainly get back to you and you know, other than maybe some one-offs here and there, mm-hmm. like we may fabricate some braces, should they break or something like mm-hmm. that. The regular sustainable parts we put on, mm-hmm. we don't fabricate any.
Do you understand why I would be concerned about that?
About the parts
that staff manufacturing parts, essentially kind of forging parts in the shop that should be provided by a supplier, that concerns about safety or liability or the technical capacity of our staff who are, should be maintaining something and they're in the manufacturing lane.
Mr. Dormson's question is much more comprehensive than I think, because what I hear you're saying is that we assume that all parts are going through some manufacturing request, and thus someone is manufacturing those here at WMATA and being using those as manufacturers. Is that the question?
I just wanted to know if there were categories of parts where our inventory had been exhausted. If that's the case, one, in and of itself, that's very concerning. Two, if the staff, in an effort to make the line on a daily basis, is working around or retrofitting parts or self-manufacturing parts, we may have a much larger problem.
Okay.
Well, I think that's a question that I think we should have.
We do not manufacture parts for the rail cars.
Well,
we'll take one of the things we'll do is we'll take them from other cars. Something like a bracket, something like a bracket we may manufacture ourselves, but certainly other components, friction rings, brake discs, journal bearings, electronic components, items like that will not be fabricated by.
I think
we
the
have
discussion,
a very strict engineering process to make sure.
I think the discussion has, I think, provoked a need to have a much more comprehensive response and fill in all of those questions that are there so that we'll be clear, and hopefully you then have the opportunity also to explore what may be going on.
Good. Just one other question has to do with labor policies. I assume that the staff that work on the mechanical side of the business are allowed breaks.
Can I interrupt you just for a moment? I'm sorry. And the reason I want to get through the agenda item, but if it's not related to the agenda item, can you hold it and provide the question to Mr. Truffin at another time? We really do have two items that are left on the agenda. And unless the labor question has to do with the vital signs or some of the other
It does have that, directly to do with the vital signs.
Okay.
It has to do with the issue of this board's responsibility to get at the root causes of why the vital signs are all pointed in, other than the escalators and elevators, are all pointed in the wrong direction. This is probably the worst vital signs report that we've seen. Well, so are we not?
I'm sorry.
Should I mute myself?
So, Lake, if that's your question, go ahead. I just wanted to make sure that we were staying on target.
I do want to stay on target. That's why I come here. Back to my question about the mechanical side of the business, which is very troubling to me. And this is, I think, the essence of why we're having a difficult time achieving the results that we want. My question is, are the mechanics allotted a break time when they're at the yard, like the Carmen Turner facility, for instance? They are?
Yes.
Okay. is it acceptable that the mechanics set up a cornhole game on the shop floor, and during their breaks, this is a game that you would play at a beach or a backyard party event? They have set, because I've witnessed them playing cornhole in the middle of the work day.
Yeah, you and I were actually visiting.
Okay. Is that?
Well, I called at that time to understand what that was, and that was they were actually on their lunch break. I wanted to understand that.
Okay. But I just have a concern that we're having a serious issue with the maintenance of our vehicles, and the staff are playing a game that is enjoyable, and I play it myself when on leave at the beach or at a family barbecue. But that seems to be set up right on the shop floor. That's a regular kind of course of business. I wondered if that might have some concern for management.
In that particular, that had a concern for me when I saw it. That's mm-hmm. why I made the call to understand what the time frame was for that. So I don't think that it's a systemic issue that we have a problem with, people being engaged in work. I find that when I go into the shop floor, during the periods of time that they need to work, that they're only working. And that specific time was specifically during the lunch break.
Jack?
It was done during their lunch break. There are alarms or whistles that go off to identify what time your break is, what time your break is out. And in the main shop, that's usually in the, they start at 6 o'clock in the morning, so 10:30 or so, whenever the tour took place, they were participating in that. And we know it looked bad.
I don't want to be Scrooge.
No,
I'm
not
a little concerned.
We're getting the 8 hours of work.
And the numbers are telling.
I understand.
Thank you. Thank you for your report. Let's move on to this next item, and we're going to try and move quickly through these. Ms. Cannon, can you go ahead and let's try and finish on that limited time that we have there and go over the presentation here. And this is on the bus service delivery.
It is. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the board. We'll move through this rather expeditiously. Back in December, there was a question proposed to this board in the context of the budget discussion. The question was whether or not there was potentially a financial rationale for divesting of Metrobus's local service and allowing the jurisdictions to operate those using their own operating costs. And if that was, in fact, a consideration, should we, in fact, be considering that?
I've got the control, sir.
Thank you. If, in fact, that was an option that we should be considering, should this board take that up? And so at that point in time, the board charged staff to conduct some analyses and report back on this discussion. And so in order to actually answer that question, what staff have to do is to analyze. So theoretically, that would be a business decision. Should we impart to Metrobus business models for operating and then impart those upon the service and make those the parameters by which we decide what, in fact, Metrobus would operate regionally and what, in fact, we would then charge out to the jurisdictions for contract service and what the jurisdictions, in fact, should operate. So in order to do that, we would have to have these business rules applied and decide and evaluate how a regional service is performing and a non-regional service is performing. What we learned in the course of the analysis very early on, and we were hoping to bring this back to you in July. I apologize for the delay because the scheduling was kicked to this month. But the heart of the matter is that what we currently call regional and non-regional is a very thorny and somewhat complicated issue. The classifications that we currently run are legacy classifications, and we may call some service regional, but not all of them really function as regional. And in certain cases, we call some service local, but it's functionally regional. So before we get into this business decision and allow you to have the discussion, the first step that staff had to do was actually begin to update the definitions of regional and non-regional and work with the jurisdictional partners to agree upon a business operating model for Metrobus. So we worked over the last many months I think that someone keeps on adjusting the slides for
someone's
me.
Someone's helping.
Refrain. Thank you. Appreciate it. Ghost in the machine. It's the new technology in the room. So what we did is we worked hand-in-hand with jurisdictional DOTs to take a look at the current regional definitions. And for those board members who are less familiar with how we got here, the current regional and non-regional definitions are really the legacy of a 1997 study in 1998 board action that at the time really saved Metrobus. Really propped up the finances of a service that was having some financial difficulty. And the recommendation at the time was to divide the service into region-provided services that the entire compact would fund and, quote-unquote, local service, which we would provide on a contract basis to jurisdictions that did want to have those routes. And so this creation of this model allowed Metrobus to both ensure the integrity of the regional service, but also to continue in operation, provide things like interjurisdictional connections and the level of service that we have today. And you can see the criteria on the board. It's also summarized in your board materials. I won't go through them in depth here, but you can see that the intent here was to construct some operational definitions that would tell us when everyone's paying versus when one jurisdiction is paying. And the output of that now, 15 years later, or so, more than 15 years later, is that we have a regional bus system which has increased total ridership by 26% since that time. On Metrobus alone, our ridership has actually gone up by 10%, even though our market share of total bus trips has gone down by 10%. Part of that is the fact that over the time period, we've actually been able to add about 32% additional service miles. Meantime, our local sister partners have added about 175% additional service miles, so significant growth by our local participants in the regional bus network, and some growth by us all to keep up with increased demand on bus service regionally. But Metrobus still does continue to carry 70% of the regional bus ridership. And we currently operate 161 lines, 318 routes, and with a fleet of about 1,500 buses. That includes our spares and strategic buses, et cetera, et cetera. So both the fleet composition as well as a snapshot, this is our weekday operating costs and operating subsidy, which comprises about 82% of the total cost and subsidy to operate the system, is on the board in front of you. One of the fascinating things, again, applying the 97 rules to how the system we have today, those 318 routes, is that the analysis suggests that not all of the routes and lines we operate are functionally regional. About 29 lines don't actually go interjurisdictionally. About 50 lines are not meeting the cost efficiency criteria that were set up in 97. Nine of the lines don't meet two of the criteria, and until recently we had one line we were operating that didn't meet any of the criteria at all. We recently were able to transfer that back to Prince George's County. That was W15. But the question that both metro planners and jurisdictional planners sought to answer was, what business model are we actually running, and is the service that Metrobus is running truly regional in nature? Because if the board is going to embrace the purpose of evaluating the business of Metrobus, it needs to know what it's working with. So the goal, the step one in this, is to move from the today definition of fiscally regional, which has served us well for the past almost two decades, but to use modern data, use an updated assessment criteria to have truly functional, to establish an actual business model for a regional Metrobus service. And that's what we proposed in your documents today. We're proposing that we consider updating the definitions and move away from the previous criteria, which had some vagueness, if you will. So, for instance, if a line happened to cross in a jurisdiction by a half mile and just touched the new jurisdiction, it was considered interjurisdictional. Well, we know in this region, being regional could be staying within one jurisdiction. There's lots of activity centers in Fairfax County, is very large. Montgomery County is very large. The district has lots of different places that connected form regional activity centers, and connecting those places is a regional type of connectivity, even though it doesn't cross jurisdictional boundaries. We also know that we have means to measure the directness of the route and the cost performance of these routes. And so what you see in front of you is a proposed update to these criteria, and the proposal here is that we would call regional now lines that connect, it would have to connect two regional activity centers. They would have to operate at least 50% of their route on an arterial road with direct service. So we couldn't actually measure this in 97. We now have the GIS capacity to actually take a look at how direct the service is. We'd like to have high ridership lines that are both showing high ridership on the weekday, as well as having a high revenue, a ridership per revenue hour. So that's the total time that bus is out of the garage and serving people, not just moving around. And then finally, guaranteed access. So can Metrobus be the regional backbone for places that no one else can or will go? Because it is our job to be the regional transit provider. So those critical job centers, those critical missing links, late night when rail isn't running, or places where other bus services can't or won't go, we would fill those gaps. Were we to adopt this criteria and apply it to the current lines, so no redrawing of the map yet, but our current allocation of lines, we would see that some of the lines we currently operate would be demoted to non-regional, and some of the lines that currently we are operating, but in fact function much more fiscally regional, would become promoted to regional. So this is in essence, reshuffling the deck and the beginning point for the board to consider how efficient the service is and whether we should be operating all the regional or non-regional or simply only the regional. We conducted this analysis and provided that in conjunction with your representatives from your DOTs and as well as we've worked this through with the JCC. That's step one. Step two, of course, is, well, that's all well and good. You've updated how many lines should in fact be called regional. What about the locally provided service? Are there services that would meet this criteria? And we had these discussions with the local providers, and the analysis tells us there's about 13 lines that, were they to be absorbed by Metro, would in fact qualify, would in fact meet these criteria. Whether or not discussions with the local jurisdictions means that those transfers would take place is something that would have to be discussed in an implementation phase. Not all the jurisdictions were at present favorable to this proposition, and we would have to decide as a board whether or not that was something that we would want to consider pursuing, and if so, under what conditions. So what does this mean? There are a variety of different implementation steps here should the board want to continue to have this discussion. The first thing, of course, is to do nothing, all the way up to really move aggressively and work and do the hard work with the jurisdictions to not only divest of or decant the local service to the local operators that doesn't meet the regional criteria, and then to absorb the truly regional service. And the implications to Metro, from a fiscal standpoint, are as follows. If we were to simply only operate the regional service and, again, decant that local service, we would take a look at roughly a $70 million transfer reduction in our total operating costs for the weekdays, and a subsidy reduction of $50 million. And you can see that if we then went back and absorbed some of the regional service back from the locals, those 13 lines, those numbers go up because we're taking on more service. This is where there's some room for debate. Is it more cost-effective for local jurisdictions to operate this service than for Metrobus to operate these local services? Using the best data that's out there, so using the National Transit Database, we see that our direct costs can be seen as comparing favorably with the locally provided direct cost. The one jurisdiction that does their accounting in the same way, full cost accounting that we do for service, including some of the admin and overhead and information technology, fleet depreciation, is Montgomery County's ride-on service. So if we were to compare their direct cost of about $111 per platform hour against our $132 per platform hour, one might say, well, we're going to have to pay for the service anyway. Why don't we simply continue to contract for Metro? Plus, you have the garages, you already have the fleet, et cetera, et cetera. Some of the jurisdictions have at least reported out much lower costs, and whether or not the jurisdictions want to have that discussion with us and whether they can really substantiate those from an operating standpoint is a topic for future negotiation and implementation. And the reasons for that is where the different operators account for things like admin, overhead planning, IT. We, of course, load things up like fuel and insurance and all those things into our total loaded cost. Not all the operators report out their costs that way. But, of course, there's some thinking that if the service is more closely held by the jurisdictions, then they might be able to manage the costs better or think about route provision or service provision in a more nimble way than Metro can. So that's a summary of where this top-level analysis led us. I think that what's important for the board to take away, though, is that this process of updating the definitions may, in fact, be something that we can and should do. So apply a business model, agree on it. We've already done that work with your representatives. We can begin to move that through, and if the board wants to direct us to finalize the updating of the regional definitions, great, we can move forward and begin to do that. But over the, from a big picture standpoint, this transfer of routes may be politically thorny, and really, the big picture is that it may in fact not bend the cost curve significantly for bus. And so the deeper question that we all need to wrestle with, not just Metro, but all of the regional bus providers, is how do we bend this cost curve for Metro bus? The things that we can and should be doing from a regional standpoint, it should be part and parcel, really the heart and soul of this discussion. I show for you a chart that gives you a perspective into what we call deadhead. Now, deadheading is it's not an archive, it's not a throwback to some 1970s era party, but rather it's what we call time that bus is rolling, but not actually doing anything. Right? It's going to and from the garages to begin service, perhaps accounting for interlining. Right now, that's about 22% of our total system miles and growing. Part of this is driven by decisions that we collectively have made as a region to locate our garages further and further away from where our service actually begins. Over the last, between 2007 and 2015, decisions about garage locations have forced Metrobus to absorb about $620,000 in additional operating costs every single year to account for deadhead that we have to incur when we take a garage that's well located for service and trade it out for cheaper real estate somewhere else that's less competitive for service. By 2025, with the proposed closing of Northern and relocation to the expanded Bladensburg, we're going to start taking on an additional $610,000 per year in deadhead. So is that worth it? The full cost accounting would have to we'd all have to ask, is the real estate decision we're making to not locate these garages where, in fact, the service is needed, worth the additional operating subsidy? Second thing we can do is we've got to speed these buses up. As we've talked before, this region is number one in congestion, and our service has lost 1 mile per hour in operating speed, and the jurisdictions have lost 3 miles per hour in operating speed over the last 15 years. Right now, you know, just the data tells us that on average our buses on our busiest routes are stopped half the time. About 30% of that is due to congestion on the roads, and about 25% of that is due to having the doors open. So if we don't get those buses moving, then we're just paying them to stand still. Simple analysis that we've brought forth to you and Jim has brought forth to you a couple times is that if we can make and commit to the running way improvements, traffic signal priority, lane queues, running way improvements, lane prioritization, bus lanes, we can not only get those buses moving faster, but we can save enough money in the operating and capital to more than pay back the investments within a reasonable return on investment horizon. So these investments are ones that we don't control the roads, we don't own the roads, and this improves not only Metrobus, but all the bus services. So every bus operator in the region would benefit from making these running way improvements. Finally, we're looking at ways to reduce dwell time on the system. Right now, when you go to, we do allow cash loading on buses, and what we've been exploring is the extent to which we can move the payment from the buses to off the buses so that you're paid before you go out and you're still tapping the target. It's a very exciting opportunity that right now, I know Federal City Council is excited to work with us on and perhaps spearheading and getting off the ground and perhaps being part of the investment catalysis to get going. But these types of efforts, again, reduce dwell time, get the buses moving, and allow us to pay less to run the buses. So in closing, we'd like you to consider adopting a modernized regional service definition to explore funding of those critical investments, the garages, the running way improvements, the off-port fare payments, so that we can get the buses stopped less and moving more. If the board does want to really begin with a clean slate approach and redraw the map, that's something that we can consider as well. We're not funded to do it today, nor is something that we've discussed in depth with the jurisdictions of our city. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the board.
Thank you. Thank you for introducing that item. I think today is really a difficult time with the number of things we have going forward, but I do want to have some discussion on this because this has been an issue that has come and gone back several times, and I think it would be good to decide how we move forward on it. And so for that reason, I want to open the floor up for discussion for about 5 minutes or so, and then we kind of keep moving on. And Mr. Yule, I'll start with you. Is there anybody over here so we don't know what we're doing?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the presentation. And certainly, as we look at our overall financial plight and the challenges we face, it behoves us to look at the areas where we can generate some cost savings. And I'm not knocking, you know, the proposal, the recommendations, and the study, and everything else. A couple of questions I have is, at least through my staff's analysis here, is that if Wamata applies these criteria to the system, we believe that Virginia would lose a significant number of regional routes, Maryland would gain a similar number, and the district would have almost the same number of regional routes. Is that accurate or not? Is that too early to reach that conclusion?
Yeah, to my understanding, there would be roughly, I mean, the exact numbers right now. So in the district, we would go from 42 regional lines to 43 regional lines. In Maryland, go from 27 regional lines to 37. And then in Virginia, we'd go from 37 regional lines to 28 regional lines. And remember, the designation of state classification for regional line is based upon the total amount of service miles that are the jurisdiction that hosts the most number of service miles of a particular line. So some of those lines do cross jurisdictional boundaries.
Okay. And very good point. And then as a result, piggybacking what you just said, it appears that Virginia would pay higher subsidies for providing these additional regional services, mm-hmm. particularly like to Maryland.
So the preliminary, this is not a final subsidy analysis, but the preliminary analysis is such that the subsidy for the regional service would be essentially flat in the district, would go slightly up in Maryland because of the addition of regional lines, and would go slightly down in Virginia. Now, there's a gross subsidy model as well that has to feed in there, but it's reflective largely of the number of lines that are being provided at the regional level.
Okay. And then final statement, obviously not only WMATA, but the North Virginia Transportation Commission as well. We're going to have to study this and make some comments, but I think for North Virginia, we will end up having significant gaps in connectivity. Is that a fact? Is that too early to tell?
Well, this analysis took into account the existing bus network as the playing field, so to speak. So the go-forward question is, are there gaps today? If there are gaps today in the network, then this analysis held those gaps constant. Should there be additional bus service is the right question to ask, one that this study did not seek to answer. We're hoping to be able to answer that in conjunction with the local providers. Thumbs up.
Ms. Porter, you start. In terms of what you're asking for from us today, my understanding is that you are basically getting the board's feedback on the issue of the definitions. You're not asking us to make a decision today on whether we would implement them or not. And presumably, before we were asked to make that decision, we would have some of the numbers that Mayor Yule was asking for. So we're just talking about the definitional issue right now. And then, of course, as you pointed out, if we did decide to implement the definitional issue, then there are steps beyond that that the board could but wouldn't necessarily have to consider. And I would expect that you would probably, as you anticipated, get some pushback on some of those changes. In terms of the issue of the definitions themselves, it seems logical to do the kinds of things that you're proposing. And as you pointed out, some of the changes are based on information that we didn't have when the first system was put together. Mm-hmm. But certainly utilizing the regional activity centers as a main piece of the criteria, one of the things that we talked about in our goals is making those kinds of regional connections and redefining our bus service so that we focus our WMATA bus service, the type of service, the regional service that all the jurisdictions pay for, we focus that on connecting regional activity centers, I think is a real move forward that really enhances our ability to talk about moving people across the region. So I appreciate that very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. As someone who's been really interested in this question really the whole time I've been here, I appreciate the work that everybody's done. I do want to echo a piece of what Mr. Yule said. Northern Virginia Transportation Commission is beginning a bus study. involving the very jurisdictions on the Virginia side of the river who participate in this organization. And that is all teed up to feed into what the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority will do in about 18 months, which is adopt a new long-range strategic plan for the region that will guide our regional investments. So it's really important that we understand what else is going on. I don't know if Maryland has something similar going on, but I think that would be of great interest if that is the case. District does its own deal all the time. So figuring that out, we talked a lot during the strategic planning process about our role as convener in the region, that we have a lot of expertise, but we don't have to necessarily control everything. And I think that is the role we should be playing here, is convener, because the most important question, I think, is how do we help more people choose transit? How do we position what we're all doing now in our various ways to provide better and greater connectivity for people? Now, I will say that now we're putting my Arlington hat on. I want everybody to understand that one of the jurisdictional proposed routes is a route that runs, that's an ART bus run, that bus that runs from Columbia Pike up to the Orange Line Corridor. It doesn't leave Arlington. It was started by Arlington to serve Arlingtonians. Other people do, I'm sure, ride it, who need to get from the corridor to businesses or who, you know, to businesses on the pike. It is our most productive route. If we put more service out, everybody rides it. If you took that out of our portfolio and it moved over into Metro's portfolio, it would change our whole rate of recovery for our system, for the ART system that operates in Arlington. So when we come back and we start to focus on money, it's going to have a different complexion than when we start from a place of what do we want for our riders? Where are the big gets? I would say Bill's jurisdiction and mine have been talking about off-vehicle fare collection, again, the whole time I've been on this board, because we want a metro way to have that. There are all kinds of barriers, but off-vehicle fare collection has tremendous potential to shorten dwell times and get the buses moving. So if Metro's going to solve any problem, this is one Metro should be trying to solve, because we are the big technology purveyors, and we should figure that one out. So I think in this, we need to struggle a little bit more with what's the catalytic thing we can do, and then how can we convene the conversation regionally about how we might provide better service collectively, given that different jurisdictions have done different things over time to solve different problems. And the last thing I would say is, and again, an Arlington example of why having control of your buses matter. We had a situation a couple of years ago where an evening adult ESL program moved its location. And we're talking a couple hundred people who go to this program. And the bus didn't go there. And so the enrollment for this free program just went away. And somebody called ART and said, is there any way that you guys can make a route adjustment to get these people to this program? And over the course of a very short period of time, our guys figured out how to do that and how to make the bus run late enough so that when they left the class, they could get on the bus. If we had to go to regional public hearing to solve a problem like that, the program would have died. And so we need to also understand where flexibility and nimbleness really is critical in meeting the needs that we have. So I'd like to see you, Sean, come back to us with a convening conversation that ties into other regional planning on bus. How can we help with that? And I'd like really to focus on the off-bus, off-vehicle fare collection and any urging we can do to get dedicated bus lanes, which is the hardest ask of all and has to be done by the jurisdictions.
Mr. Belgian, and
to being able to fully engage. And I appreciate the issues of balancing out the portfolio of local transit systems, having started the ART 41, but on the same time, we have to look at the total bottom line, because whether it's a metro bus or a local bus, it's still being funded, especially in Virginia, by the local government. And if we already have assets, and that's one of the things that the Region Mobility Panel agreement allowed, was for Metro to make the multi-year plans necessary to sustain the facilities and sustain the fleet in an efficient and effective manner. And when there's a question as to what size that feature is, how many buses, how many facilities, where they're located, then it makes it very difficult for us to take those actions and make the investments that are needed to keep up with a growing ridership and the crowding and on-time challenges that we face every day.
So I got a question for our elected officials, and Mary, you can try to help me answer this. Our powerful transportation planning board, the MPO, you all did a study 3-4 years ago about connecting activity centers, and with a lot of them. Is that the 30,000 feet plan that was adopted at the TPB that we're now trying to shoehorn in the bus section of that plan?
I would not describe it as that. I think it's very much a part of that in any way, because the TPB side is trying to provide connectivity to activity centers.
Right.
But the how-to and the whereabouts is not part of this definition.
Right, so, Sean, are we hitting all of that TPB activity centers in this activity?
It doesn't.
Are we connecting them all?
So, not all of them.
How much? Oh, okay.
Quite a
few?
There are more than 140. Right.
How many are we trying to do in this exercise?
Oh, I don't have the number of them. I know that in this exercise, what we're trying to have is have our service connect at least two activity centers per bus line. So, I mean, but Mr. Bulger, your question is an important business consideration question. Is it our job to spread the service out like peanut butter so that we connect as much of the region as possible, regardless of the cost, or to establish a business model that is data-driven and then apply that service where, in fact, the conditions on the ground suggest that we do that? That would be the way to approach this, using the information we provided to you in a business decision fashion, as opposed to a service or plan decision fashion. I think that is the spirit of the question that the board asked in December.
Well, then I would give my vote to move ahead, notwithstanding the TPB connection issue or plan, which has too many activity centers that we can't serve. I'd like to. And let's go to more of a business approach. Come back to us with some kind of cooperative agreement amongst and between the various jurisdictions as to the definition and the funding efficiencies that you have explained. So I'm all for it, notwithstanding all the connections that we can't make.
I would just say that, you know, for a long time it's been the case that the local jurisdictions took the WMATA routes that were best performing, kept them for themselves, and, reduced the subsidy that they had to pay by running those routes, often cheaper than WMATA was able to run them on an hourly basis. And I think for a lot of reasons that's going to be kind of hard to unwind. But I do think what you presented to us, Shyam, suggests that you have the ability to quantify and monetize the actions that local jurisdictions take that either help or hinder the efficiency of bus operations, and that theoretically could affect the bus subsidy. So whether that is moving the bus barn, closing one that's centrally located and requiring one to be opened that's much further away, whether that's doing changes to provide dedicated rights of way for the buses, that could greatly reduce the operating cost of a line. And I'm just saying that it might be easier to have this conversation with jurisdictions if we could talk about it in terms of how it affects their operating subsidy very specifically and when they might recover their costs for doing this work. And I think you're very close to being there, but I think that would actually help us to have that conversation. And I know lots of other people have said to you, come back to us. That would be something I think we could have very specific conversations with jurisdictions about. And there are things to be fixed that require a lot of regional cooperation. Onboard fare collection when everyone uses it, or offboard when everyone uses a different system is one issue. Remember how we tried to work signal prioritization, right, with that Tiger grant? Oh, my God. So there are lots of things that we need to try to fix regionally, but even these signals, if a local jurisdiction could make, in the course of their normal capital budgets, access improvements that increase the transit shed, like that is a net positive in many cases in terms of an operating subsidy. I just don't think we're putting things in those terms for jurisdictions clearly enough, but I think you have the ability to do that. So I think for me that's the next iteration of this idea.
Let me see if I can wrap something up, and because I really do think that this begs a broader discussion at a broader table, and that is with the jurisdictions coming together with Metro, so that we can, rather than get in the room as a recommendation, really explore all of the entities of this change that has the impact as well as the advantage. And I keep coming back to the connectivity piece. I understand the business model. The business model is very important. But in the end, everybody sitting at the table is going to pay, and we're going to pay no matter what. And so what's our next question? And to me, is what kind of outcome do we bring to our riders? And as we make the decision, do we have it as comprehensive as possible so that we can all feel comfortable and say, yes, let's move forward. So I think coming back and finding a way where we can utilize the jurisdictional folks at the table, and I think that includes our board members now, and trying to hash out some of the concerns that may be raised as we look at some of the issues. I really do think the facility issue is a challenge because some decisions have been made that are long term and they're not going to be changed in the short term. So that's going to mean looking at some of this differently in terms of how you look at a service, actually. Surely well over the long term of how we define service. So I really think that is the best way to start this. But I think to keep on track with it, because having efficient bus service is one of the best ways to expand the Metro transit service that we have. And we all pay for all of it. Are there any other
comments? Improved service is clearly something we want to do for the region. I think we also want to look at the costs for the region. But what I see here, if we can all get to the table and talk about it, is this is not a zero-sum game. This is not just passing spot from one to the other. There are opportunities where everybody could come out better on the bottom line. And jurisdictions would still have the choice. Would they run their own service or would they contract with us? But if the bottom line total can be improved, there's no losers in that proposition.
Madam Chairman, I just want to add, it was difficult putting this presentation together because this was a result of an action that was suggested last year that essentially really doesn't save money. Just as the chairman says, it just moves money around. So we went through the items that where the money can be saved: off-board fare payment, speeding buses up, moving a bus from one jurisdiction. You know, we're receptive to talking to the jurisdictions, working with the jurisdictions. They make those kind of service changes, but that's not where the big money is. The bigger money is moving buses faster so we can provide more service, collect more revenue, and support. Again, getting those speeds up is really very important, and getting the payment off of the bus are the big issues where you save money. Yes, moving bus garages generally creates deadhead, but I think that's a reality of life. I don't know that there's a way around that. But again, we're at least making progress and putting some new facilities in place. And I know the jurisdictions have the same challenges with facilities and buses. So, again, any way that we can move buses, and not just Metro buses, all buses faster, fare collection faster, are the ways that I think that's where the subsidy gets reduced. And it's a better service, absolutely.
All righty. Thank you very much. We'll figure out how we get back to the table.
Thank you.
Mr. Kent, thank you very much. That isn't the actual concluding statement, but I really do think that this agenda is much heavier than we could, and I don't want to undermine the importance of your presentation, so I'll ask you if you'll come back on the next.
And we have the report in front of us.
Yes, and we do have a report. Okay. With that, we are adjourned.